Hello, thank you all for the opportunity. This is Oncology Decoded, where cancer science meets clarity. We started this, as many of you know, to try to change the way data is interpreted. Most oftentimes, as everybody knows, a lot of the scientific data gets published and it's usually stored in reputable journals. And how do you move that to clinics? And so Ben and I have done this now for the last couple of months, and that was the premise of why we did Oncology Decoded. But here we have the privilege and sincere thank you to the P&T for letting us do a live episode of how we look at data. And a special treat here is that we're going to be looking at ASCO GU data that was presented and how PTF, along with community oncology, will look at that data as well and how we can translate it into the practice for oncology. Are we able to see Ben? Ben, welcome.
Can you hear me? Can you
Can you
see
see
me?
it?
All right. Ha, thanks, Manoj. So, I'll just go ahead and introduce myself, and then we can introduce some of the others on stage. So good to see that we have a nice panel on stage. My name's Ben Garmazy. I wish I could have been there in Denver. Unfortunately, I am stuck in clinic. And for those of you who are doing research with SDRI at Sarah Cannon Research Institute, we have some meetings this weekend, so I couldn't leave Nashville. I think we're really excited about this podcast. It's interesting. It's unique. Amy, thanks for the introduction. I'm actually not cool enough to be on the podcast committee, so I will leave that designation for the three on stage. But I am a GU medical oncologist, heavily engaged in research as well as standard of care patients in Nashville, Tennessee. Thanks, Manoj.
So we'll introduce the rest of the panel. We have Dr. John Burke. John?
Yeah, John Burke. I practice in Denver, and I'm the chair of the PTF.
Oh, hi, I'm Dhaval Shah. I'm practicing in Delaware. I'm chair of the GU Pathways on the Pathways Task Force.
So yeah, Ben, we're definitely missing you here. We get to wear these really cool like musicians where we have these headphones that are going around us. So we don't have to do the lapel mics anymore. So it's much better.
There you go.
But
I can see it. You look very tech. And Duvall, now I know who I need to beg to get the job of getting on the committee. So for everyone in the audience, we know who's at fault for me not being on that. I'm completely joking, but all right, thanks.
so with that, we'll start off the session. We're going to start off with topics of discussion. So we're going to look at three different trials. We're going to look at KEYNOTE-564 in the adjuvant kidney cancer, Niagara, which was a perioperative bladder cancer trial, and then we'll look at TELEPRO-2 at first line mCRPC. And so, Ben, do you want to start us off?
Yeah, I'm happy. Let's move on to the next slide. I'd like to thank you, Manoj, for running the slides for us today. And before we start talking about adjuvant kidney cancer and KEYNOTE-564, which is what I like to do, I know most of you pretty well, but John, I don't think I know you as well. And I would like to ask a question before we get started. As far as when we think about pathways and all this stuff, and we're going to talk about some of that on the podcast today, as well as for those of you in the room attending the conference. But I would like to know what your opinion is on just what is the purpose of pathways? What's the purpose of a P&T committee? How does that help those of us in community oncology that maybe this is some vague thing that happens behind the scenes? How does that actually help? And before you answer that, I hear a bit of an echo. So if you guys hear an echo in the audience, maybe those folks running the tech can get that fixed while you answer. All right, thanks.
Yeah, just th thanks for the question. I think as a general comment, what the Pathways Committee tries to do is that, we have all this data coming at us all the time, and then you look and we, in order to sort of try to make decisions for patients, you have guidelines, right? And so, guidelines a lot of us refer to are NCCN guidelines. ASCO has guidelines. ASH has guidelines. A lot of our professional societies have various guidelines. And the guidelines and the FDA, review the scientific data, and then try to apply
Ben,
that
real
to
quick, this is
practice.
Mark with
And where
production. You're just hearing the
Pathways
room
tries to
mics
build on
picking up
that and
yourself. It sounds
differentiate
great in the
ourselves
room. So
from those
everything's fine here.
guidelines is by considering value. So that's really, and the value equation is not easily defined. Part of it is the cost of the drug. But part of it also is, you know, how much benefit is there of a drug? What kind of clinical benefit are patients getting from a drug or a regimen? Part of it is also toxicity. Part of that equation is toxicity. Is this a drug or regimen that's, you know, highly toxic or not so toxic? And so those are kind of the primary considerations we look at. And so what our committee does is we take NCCN guidelines. It's actually called Value Pathways Powered by NCCN. That was the original name when this NCCN joint venture kind of happened. So we take NCCN guidelines and we say, okay, all these, you know, these 10 regimens might be on NCCN guidelines, but which of these do we think provides the most value for the patient in terms of clinical benefit, favorable toxicity, and cost? And we try to narrow it down. And so the end result is that our pathways are a subset of NCCN guidelines, and hopefully that translates into good things for the network. That is, doctors who are trying to choose regimens for patients can choose regimens that are providing more value than, say, others that might still be on guidelines. And it also, the hope is that it'll lead to sort of more consistency among the practices and help us in other ways. So that's kind of a short version of what we think pathways are trying to achieve.
No, I think that's really helpful. Sorry, Manoj, were you speaking?
Yeah, I was even going to ask a follow-up question on that, but go ahead and I'll ask afterwards.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think that's really helpful because, you know, I personally don't use pathways. Maybe I'm going to get in trouble here by saying that out loud, but I think I've used it before at prior practices, and I think the NCCN guidelines are complicated, and unless you are truly only seeing certain disease types, it is very hard to digest that and make that an easy understanding. So I think that's really interesting, really helpful. And I think that's going to guide our conversation as the level setting of what is the purpose of what we're doing. And then you're going to teach me about what you do, because I actually don't know quite how this is done behind the scenes. And I've also been, you know, for all of those that were stressing in the room, I've been assured my voice sounds wonderful. So you are all welcome. But I've been told that it was just a technical glitch on my side, and I just need to deal with my own vibrations in the room. All right, so Manoj, I'm about to move on to keynote 564, but before we go on,
I have a question. John, yeah. Or Duval, what happens if something is not on pathway in a community setting? How does a treating physician go about addressing that, right? So we're talking about value, but then you see all these new data, and then you look at how long does it take to get onto a pathway. And if you know, everybody wants to give the greatest or the newest drug and not necessarily wait that long. So how do you navigate that kind of situation?
I think the pathway still allows to access those regimens either by, there is, you know, clear mechanism to access those drugs either through not pathway defined or undefined. And I think then it depends on, you know, the other things that go into care of a patient once the regimen is defined or selected, how the payer is going to pay for it. The pathways really tries to help community oncologists select majority of the treatment decisions. Not every patient can be treated using pathways. I think we know that limitation of the pathway, but I think that's how you can access some of the not pathway defined regimens.
Yeah, I mean, just add to that, I think if I as a physician see a patient with bladder cancer and I want to give drug X, and drug X has been, you know, let's say minimally studied in bladder cancer, and the value of that might be debatable, it's not on pathways. To my knowledge, no practice in our entire network that says that I cannot give that drug. I can prescribe whatever drug I want. So there's no sort of chain or prison that I'm going to go to if I give this drug to a patient. Each practice handles that situation differently, and it has to do with kind of the finances. And in some practice, they might say, well, look, if you give this drug and it doesn't get paid for, you're on the hook for some of the costs of that, some or all the costs of that treatment if our practice doesn't feel that that's sort of within the realm of, you know, conventional practice. So there might be some financial implications for me as a provider, but there's nobody telling me I can't do that.
I'll turn it back to you, Ben.
All right. Okay, good. I think that's helpful. So let's look at a case series. I'll remind everyone not to give away state secrets, right? So anything that needs to stay internal, to USON and US Oncology P&T Committee, please, we can always edit it out, but please, please don't give away that information. So I don't know how many of those of you in the room or listening to this podcast know a ton about kidney cancer. So we'll do just a little bit of level setting. Keynote 564 really kind of changed the paradigm of how we treat patients with curative intent renal cell carcinoma. So this is a study that looked at the adjuvant setting. So patients that had surgical resection of a kidney cancer lesion, it had to be clear cell renal cell carcinoma. That's about 70-ish percent of patients with RCC. And they had to have some kind of intermediate high or high risk features. So those are patients with PT2 staging with sarcomatoid features, or any T3, T4 staging, or any node positive, or even 5% of patients that were had an oligometastatic site that was surgically resected to render them no evidence of disease. All of those patients were included and then randomized to pembrolizumab for a year versus placebo for a year, and with a primary endpoint of disease-free survival, but key secondary endpoints of overall survival and some safety. So let's move on to the next slide. And you can see here, this is the data, and it looks good, right? So I guess not all the numbers are necessarily on the slide, but the median disease-free survival, clear separation of the curves there, hazard ratio is 0.68. None of those curves having a total median yet because they haven't crossed. Median overall survival, the hazard ratio isn't on here, but there it is, 0.54. It's ticked up a little bit in a recent data set, but I think 0.6 something. And then about a 5% difference in overall survival long-term. So you're seeing about 1 in 20 patients are having an overall survival benefit by giving that drug because of that 5% difference. So you can see here very clear separation of the curves as time evolves in overall survival, which is what you would expect for curative intent kidney cancer. And then of course, disease-free survival separation of the curves as well. So this is what you want to see when you see a large phase 3 registrational study. Does it biologically make sense that this drug is working? Is there a statistical difference? And then you need to look at the safety, right? So we move on to the next slide. And this is the toxicity results. And you see, of course, when you give immunotherapy, that you have some side effects that are different from placebo. Now, the rate of grade 3 or grade 4 greater adverse events was about 1 in 3. We know that some of those are lab values, though, right? So lab values can get grade 3 toxicity and related adverse event. Some of those are easy to control and some of those aren't. We all know that are practicing oncologists that are seeing all tumor types how to give pembrolizumab. So we're not going to dig too much into this, but the safety was overall well tolerated for this drug. Next slide. And then you look at the quality of life, right? And the key here is that there is no statistical difference in the quality of life via three different PRO metrics. Now, of course, there's some increase in deterioration, some metrics based on side effects, so who had immune-related adverse events. But statistically speaking, it was equal, and there was no significant difference. And overall, again, the conclusion is this is a well-tolerated therapy in this patient population. We go to the next slide. And this is where I'm going to hand it over again. So of course, as a clinical trialist, right, I see this data, I say, a benefit, reasonably well-tolerated. I know that there's a risk of over and under treatment in these populations if we hold or don't hold therapy. And now I'm going to be curious, as if we pass it back to John, how does Pathways take a look at this data? And what are you looking at when you appraise this study for evaluation for clinical trial?
Yeah, thanks, Ben. I totally agree with you. As I read a study like that, my initial impression is the same, right? You got a PFS benefit, you got the data we showed were early data, but so you got a trend to an OS benefit. Yeah, 20% of people had to stop the drug because they couldn't tolerate a year's worth, but you know, we know the side effects of these drugs, and so the initial inclination is, yeah, this is great. And you know, historically, I remember, for some reason, I remember a conversation from 25 years ago when I was a fellow, and it was with one of the docs at Memorial Sloan Kettering, Len Saltz, who said to me, when you hear the words randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled phase 3 clinical trial, you're supposed to go like this and bow down at the altar, right? Because this is you know, the epitome of great science, right? Well, I think one of the things our Pathways Committee tries to do is not just assume that. And you realize that actually not every randomized trial is done perfectly, and they all in some way have flaws. And so shown here is a figure I took from a paper published by Dr. Tanek there in JCO a couple years ago that actually was a critique of the very keynote trial we're talking about here. So this was a critique of this trial. And they point out that what you want to look at when you're kind of critically taking a look at these trials, especially at this is in particular adjuvant clinical trials, is what's highlighted in the blue oval. So you want to ask yourself these questions. And I think we try to apply this on our pathways committee. We say, is the control arm appropriate? And to apply it here, placebo. Is placebo the standard of care? And I think probably everyone would agree the answer is yes. I know there's some data on sunitinib, but so that's pretty easy here. Question two is a little harder on the bottom there. Is the surrogate valid? That is one of the things these authors make the point that there are two ways that physicians can help patients. Number one, you can make them live longer. And number two, you can improve their quality of life. Everything else that we measure is an endpoint in clinical trial is a surrogate. The only things you really should care about in the end is, are you making your patients live longer or are you improving quality of life? And the question here is disease-free survival, or in many of these studies that we look at, progression-free survival, a valid surrogate? And the answer is often actually no. It's not real clear. Now, the FDA has said that this is the preferred endpoint for oncology studies. So if you look at studies from 20 years ago in oncology, we did not see nearly the number of PFS or DFS as an endpoint that you see today. And that's because of this change in the FDA and their decision to use that. But PFS and DFS have problems with them. And one of the problems we get into, and there's many, but one of the problems is the third blue oval up the top, which is called informative censoring. And informative censoring is a way, it's a form of bias that can be introduced into these trials. And there's really two primary ways informative censoring can happen. The first is if you have a trial that's randomized but not placebo controlled. Let's say you've got, a great new drug X, and then you have, standard treatment. Everyone wants to get great new drug X. And when the patients find out that they were randomized to not receive that, to receive the standard, they're kind of bummed and they may say, I'm going to go somewhere else where I can get great new drug X. So they get randomized to the control arm and they drop off of the trial. And what that does is that the patients who drop off tend to be better shape, they tend to have more resources, they can get on a plane and go to the next big academic center for another trial. So they have better performance status and a better chance of doing well. And what that process has done is it's removed those favorable patients from the control arm, and it's left the rest of the patients on the control arm looking less favorable. So it introduces a bias against the control arm. The second way one can have informative censoring is toxicity of a drug. And so if you, and here we have pembrolizumab, right? We have 20% of patients couldn't stay on the drug for a year. And if patients get pembrolizumab and have to come off because of an immediate toxicity from the drug, they never make it to their first CAT scan that says whether they have a progression event or not. And so they're censored from the trial. They come off. And what can happen from that is you've eliminated these patients who tend to have a worse performance status and tend to not be able to tolerate the treatment, and then they don't get counted in your PFS curve. And so the problem there is that your PFS in the treatment arm actually looks better than it really is because you've eliminated this poor performance status group of patients. So that's kind of what can happen with informative censoring. And so our Pathways Committee is making a strong effort to sort of look for that. Fourth is, are the patients on the control group offered optimal therapy once they have a relapse? Because that's going to be important. If pembrolizumab here is the standard of care for metastatic disease, were the patients who got placebo here offered, or did they get pembrolizumab or similar when they developed a recurrence? Because that's going to impact the overall survival. And fifth is, are the findings of this study consistent with those of other studies? Does it make sense, Ben, to your point? You said it makes sense, but do other studies, say, of similar drugs show the same outcome, and is it consistent? So those are sort of five of the critical things we want to look at when we're analyzing a trial for pathways. And that's, I think this distinguishes us from sort of that initial impression, which is, yeah, this looks great, we should just apply it to our practice.
So John, I want to be better at reading the literature, right?
Me too.
And I think four of those five things are easy for those of us who read a lot of clinical trials to do. But how can you teach me to look at informative censoring? Because I've heard that term before, but I have no idea how to look at a Kaplan-Meier curve, or do I need to go to the supplementary tables? How do you look for that in a study?
I'm going to show you. Go to the next slide. Go to the next one.
I'm always jumping the gun, so that's okay.
I talked about two ways, and so the first one is you want to find consort diagram. You want to find your consort diagram in the trial, and it's usually in the supplementary appendix. So you have to kind of hunt around for this a little bit. And what you want to look at is the discontinued treatment group, and you want to look at how many patients discontinued treatment. So in the randomization, you want to look at how many people actually received the treatment they were randomly assigned to receive. Now, in this one, it's kind of easy because it's placebo controlled. So when you're a patient and you get randomized, you have no idea whether you're getting randomized to Pembro or placebo. And so there should be no difference here in the number of patients who are actually treated. And indeed, that's what it is. If you look at that third box down, it's too small, 488 on the Pembro group received treatment, and 498 received treatment on the placebo group. So it's pretty close to that, and there's not a big difference in people. You know, they don't drop off because they don't know that they got placebo. So that's the key thing you want to look at, is to, was there a big drop off when people got randomized to the control arm? And then the other way is a little tricky. I think it might be on the next slide. You know what? I didn't make it for this one, Ben. I'll show you the other way to look for informative censoring when we talk about Niagara next.
Okay, great. All right. And then, so I guess you brought up consistency, right? And we just talked about a randomized phase 3 study with a positive result with adjuvant pembrolizumab. But of course, there's three other trials in this space with negative results. And maybe we can explain away some of them by the biology or by the drug. You had adjuvant atezolizumab, which is a PD-L1 inhibitor with no significant difference. You had adjuvant nivolumab and adjuvant nivolumab and ipilimumab with no significant difference. Now, in there, instead of 12 months, they got 6 months of therapy. So I can explain away one is maybe there's a difference between a PD-1 and a PD-L1 inhibitor. I can explain the others as maybe there's a difference between 6 to 12 months of therapy. And then you have a perioperative study where they got a dose of, you know, immunotherapy and then surgery and then adjuvant therapy. And there was a lot of censoring and dropout on that study. And that one was also negative. So we have one out of three studies positive. And I think that's when you bring up consistency. So of course, there's always the potential explanation that one drug is different than other drugs. But in this case, we like to think that PD-1 inhibitors are more similar than different. And maybe Duvall, do you have any thoughts about how we think about the, you know, pembrolizumab data in the context of these other studies?
Yeah, I mean, I think to John's point, these are all very relevant points. But when I'm actually seeing patients in the clinic, they obviously know the overall survival benefit that we have seen, and that was updated and presented. But I think if we go forward, we'll see that data that in the overall survival, when you track the patients longer, we see that patients in the adjuvant or the observation arm or placebo arm did get immunotherapy in the adjuvant set, you know, at progression. So I think that just justify at this time for me to use adjuvant pembrolizumab in the patient who will meet the criteria. What I try to do in clinic is really focus on the exact defined criteria of the trial, try not to use in patients who had non-clear cell, for example, but had, you know, a large T3 tumor. I wouldn't offer them adjuvant pembrolizumab. That's how I'm doing in clinic practice.
So I'm going to ask a question here. So, you know, obviously, when we first saw the data that came out for KEYNOTE-564, there was a lot of excitement, right? It was like, this is the first time we're actually seeing there's a great drug. We're going to use it, you know, from primarily being a junior medical oncologist, like, fantastic. I'm going to see a patient tomorrow. They're going to get this drug. It's great. We're going to save lives. But then, to your point, when pathways or committees are looking at this, you're looking at this and saying, hold it. This is probably not the right time. Is my interpretation correct? Like when does pathways say, yes, this is now the time that we need to relook at this, and then say, we have long enough data. Now we're seeing this benefit. So yes, right? Because we saw the OS data not too long ago, but
Yes.
we saw the PFS data a couple of years ago now.
Yeah, I mean, that's always a debate that we have at Pathways. And oftentimes in the Pathways call, we end up having debates for pros and cons on how we kind of vote for these drugs to go on Pathways. And I think from what I remember, we did end up using the initial data to kind of have the drug on Pathways, knowing all the nuances and what goes into what John explained. But I think the overall survival, then we do give an update on the overall survival when that's mature and that is brought back to the Pathways to relook at it. So that happens all the time. There have been many instances when overall survival did not pan out and the drugs were taken off Pathways even after they were put initially on the Pathways.
Yeah, and I think also to your question, the process of review of regimens and drugs for pathways is a continuous one. That is, we review it when the first paper comes out or when the presentation comes out, and that this paper has been published twice and maybe more, but twice in the New England Journal, and so we reviewed it at that point. And that's, you have to review it to decide, hey, is this something we should be doing? Is the data good enough to support inclusion on pathways? But then other events happen, right? So, for example, I just showed you a paper that was published that critiqued the trial. So that's the scenario where actually your committee, the GU subcommittee of pathways, reviewed that trial or reviewed that critique and said, hey, what do we think of this? Do we want to apply this to our pathways decision or do we still think this should stay on pathways? And then the paper gets published a second time for overall survival and it gets reviewed and discussed then, typically at a subcommittee level. And if the subcommittee wants to make any changes or modifications, then it's brought forward to the full committee. So it is a process of continuous review is how the pathways works.
So I just want to kind of get to this last slide here in terms of how does it actually translate to clinical practice, right?
Yeah.
So I think which is what exactly we were talking about a little while ago, which is, from a, I see this new drug, the data is in a reputable journal, New England Journal of Medicine, can't really get any better than that. And patients are seeing it. And then they come in and they say, I want this drug because it hit the criteria based on what you're seeing. And then I tell them, no, I'm not going to use it because it's not on pathway or it's not a community recommended treatment. They go to an academic center and they say, you need to get pembrolizumab, right? And so how does that work? And in a community setting, we're really trying to translate whatever we're seeing, right? What we're trying to use this exciting data and then say, this is what our colleagues need to do. So with this time that takes, any thoughts on anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I was saying earlier, like trying to stick to the exact patient who went on the trials and maybe just at least discussing adjuvant therapy with that particular patient. And then maybe trying to explain in patient language, what this nuances of this adjuvant treatment means and whether how much is the benefit and is that, benefit really 5% what we are seeing on the overall survival. I think that's the discussion that I have with the patient before recommending them the treatment.
Yeah, I mean, the scenario could be, let's say, for example, the trial that we just discussed. Let's say, and this is a hypothetical, but let's say our Pathways Committee says, no, we're not going to approve Pembro. We don't think the value is there, too toxic, too expensive, and we don't think it's should be offered to sort of the majority of patients with kidney cancer. And yet, let's say there it is in the New England Journal, it has an FDA approval. What do you do there? I mean, I think the individual physician is responsible for sort of understanding the reasons why is it not on pathway? Well, it's not on pathway because we feel there's not value to the patient. And Ben, you shouldn't feel bad because the reviewers for the New England Journal do not know anything about informative censoring and something that, and I'm not saying this paper has a ton of it, but you're not alone. And we all need to work on our games here and being more critical of these papers. So I think if you're faced with that patient in the clinic and your Pathways Committee has decided not to recommend this, you want to understand the why. Here's why we agree with this other criticism. We think the study was flawed. Whatever it is that's sort of preventing it from being accepted, and that's a discussion you need to have with your patient. Not an easy one when it's
Yeah.
like on, on NCCN guidelines,
No, absolutely. I mean, we're certainly over-treating some of these patients, right? They probably will never relapse, but we're probably are over-treating. So kind of continuing the theme, Ben, any additional thoughts that you had on this?
No, I think this is great. You know, I'm learning a lot here. I think it was very helpful to see those figures. So for those of you just listening and not watching it, maybe, you know, watch that part on video on your phone or wherever you're listening to this podcast if you're not in the room today. But I think let's move on and see what else we can learn.
So we're going to try to apply the same concept that John is talking about to two other trials. One is Niagara, which actually got its FDA approval 2 days ago or so. So this is the perioperative durvalumab in neoadjuvant bladder cancer therapy and operable bladder cancer. So, you know, again, to kind of level set, phase three, randomized control trial, cisplatin eligible muscle invasive bladder cancer patients. So T2 to T4, node one, UC or UC with differentiation. And they were randomized to gem cis durva versus gem cis alone, cystectomy, and then durva versus no treatment. And the primary endpoint being EFS and PCR, secondary endpoints being OS and then the metastasis-free survival. So very quickly, this is the event-free survival and the intent to treat population. You can see that the durvalumab is doing better compared to the comparison, which is really no adjuvant therapy. You can see that at the 12 months as well as the 24 months. Again, this is the updated event-free survival, PCR as well as non-PCR in both subgroups here when you look at the durva versus the control arm here.
This one's interesting, you know, sorry to interrupt, but you know, yeah. I'm never sorry when I interrupt. You know, even patients who got a path CR with the neoadjuvant component of this study seem to have longer benefit, at least in a subset of patients, by getting access to that durvalumab early. Because normally we think path CR, maybe they don't need anything else, but maybe they were going to do well no matter what. There's an interesting separation here, and we'll have to dig into the reasons why at another time, or perhaps as more data evolves. But I thought that was pretty interesting.
Totally agree with you, because generally thinking, we don't think about adjuvant immunotherapy and those that achieve PCR, at least not based on the NEVO data, right?
So. Wait a minute, I didn't understand. Did you just say there's more separation after the surgery? Is that what you mean?
No. So normally we would think if you got a past CR,
okay,
probably doesn't matter how you got there or what you got afterwards, you're going to do really well. And maybe you're not going to hit any kind of statistical difference with any kind of drug in bladder cancer. Here, now we don't know if those patients are getting the adjuvant durvalumab and that's leading to the separation of curves, or the access to the durvalumab in the neoadjuvant setting in addition to the chemo prime them for a more durable benefit. But right. I would have expected that those patients with now and past CR, you would have seen a big split in the curves. And those patients with past CR, those curves may be a little bit more overlapping. We're not seeing that. And that's why I think this is pretty interesting. But that's why we have to run these analyses. And of course, this is not perfectly powered to answer that individual question, but it is intriguing.
Totally agree. So here's the overall survival and the intent to treat population. You can see that there's a separation of curves with durva versus the comparison arm as well. So John, I'm going to turn it over to you for, this is the AE events before I turn it over. So really not too much of a difference when you use immunotherapy versus not, at least not in the grade 3-5. So John, coming to you, kind of looking at informative censoring in this study.
So same principle. Now this one's a little more complicated, right? Because you got the initial randomization, and then you can have people dropping off while they're on treatment. So if you look here about in the middle after they were randomized, on the durvalumab group, only two of the patients withdrew. And then in the comparison group, remember this comparison did not get a placebo, so they knew they were getting standard therapy here. Only two patients withdrew before without receiving any treatment. So there was no big drop off in those patients who were disappointed. However, you go down one more and there is a bit of a difference there. And here's what you want to look at is the number of people who discontinued treatment for reasons other than progression or death, right? So, and a lot of that is concentrated in that vague patient decision line, where on the left, you got 10 patients getting durvalumab. bailed out for whatever reason, that was their decision. Whereas on the right, the people not getting durvalumab, 30 of them bailed out due to a decision. So there's a little bit of a risk there. And I'm not saying this is a definite problem with the study, but a little bit of a risk there that those 30, that extra 20 patients, 30 minus 10, those patients were kind of disappointed that they didn't get their durvalumab. They went to their doctor and said, "Hey, I'm gonna drop out of the study. Can you give me a little Nevo after my bladder, after my cystectomy?" And went on. And so those are probably, again, they might be better performance status patients, or they have the ability to travel to another center. They might have been patients who would have done well on the control arm, and therefore their absence from that trial could impair the performance of the control arm a little bit. So I'm not saying that's the reason, but it's just a factor you want to look at and think about when you're critiquing this trial. And then Ben, you'd asked me before, the other way of looking at informative censoring, maybe go to the next slide, Manoj. This is how you do it. Now, I don't want to bore the audience. This is kind of boring, simple math. I mean, we can all do it, but I'll show you what you do. So if you look at the vertical lines, they've drawn those nice vertical lines for me, that 24 months of follow-up, and this is the PFS curves. I took the PFS curves. So, and you have the percentages in the durvalumab group, 67.8% were event-free, and in the no durvalumab group, 59.8%. Well, you should be able to multiply that number times the number who were on the arm, and that's how many should be, in theory, at risk in the bottom row under your figure there. And so what I show there is that I multiplied 0.678 times 533 were in the arm, in the durvalumab group. So there should be 361 patients at risk. And then you say, well, how many actually were at risk? Because they give you that number in the table, and it's not 361, it's 330. So there are 31 patients who are missing from that durvalumab arm. Okay, all right, so they dropped off or they went off and did something else. But you don't want that number to be like a lot higher than the no durvalumab arm, because if it is, that's a hint that those people had toxicity, they bailed out, and those are poor performance status patients, and they may not be evaluated for that PFS, and that's going to bias your curves in favor of durvalumab here. So here you got 31 missing out of the 533, so it's 5.8 in the durvalumab arm and 6.7 on the control arm. So I'm looking at those numbers and saying, not a huge difference. We're not having some mass exodus of patients off of the durvalumab arm due to toxicity. So no obvious problem with informative censoring, in my view, as I analyze that trial. So this is the kind of analysis that we're doing to kind of look for some of the flaws in the studies, Ben.
No, that's super helpful. I hope those of you listening at home, you know, you might want to put that on slow, because I think that is a really good point and something that I've should have thought about before. But again, this is why we do these things. I need to learn from my colleagues, and you just taught me something really interesting here. So I love to see that they're somewhat equal in this study, and I think that's the key takeaway. All right, Manoj, push us forward.
Yeah, so, you know, how does it translate to clinical practice, right? So now you have a good regimen, and from pathway standpoint, it seems like well-balanced, randomized, phase three, hits all the standpoints, right? Then you also have your current approved therapies, and you know, you have your docetaxel, gemcitabine. Now you have a patient. Does pathways restrict you in any way of choosing one versus the other? Everything becomes an option. How do you?
Yeah, so the pathways doesn't restrict you to any of those options. All are options. I think the way the pathways has defined, at least the Niagara trial regimen, is kind of perioperative, because we are doing durvalumab in the perioperative setting so that we can differentiate patients who got neoadjuvant chemotherapy and then went on to adjuvant nivolumab versus perioperatively they started with durvalumab with chemotherapy. I think that's how pathways allowing clinician to make decisions and whatever they seem appropriate for that patient sitting in front of them. You know, on a personal level, like how I'm making decisions, I think it's still, to me, I have not yet used this regimen. It just got FDA approved. But I think what I try to go back and see is the VESPER trial data, which shows that dose dense MVAC also has similar overall survival benefit. So if a patient is a candidate for dostarlimab, I'm still trying to use that for that patient. It's a shorter regimen, gets them to operation surgery faster. And then you can decide on the adjuvant whether they would qualify for adjuvant immunotherapy based on their FCR. Are we losing some patients? That's the question, million-dollar question that nobody knows. On the other hand, there is adjuvant trial looking at incorporating circulating tumor DNA to make that decision in the adjuvant setting if patients did not receive neoadjuvant immunotherapy. So I think that's something that we can consider. And our center has that trial open, so I'm trying to enroll patients on that trial.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, this study is informative for many reasons, right? So when you look at the creatinine clearance, it was much lower than what we've understood before. The
Well, like with dostarlimab and vec, so
yeah.
they allow lower creatinine
Yeah. The
clearance.
creatinine clearance in this study was greater than 40, which is lower than what we've historically seen. So, it raises an important question because most physicians in the community will, when you see a creatinine clearance of 50, 45, you get very alarmed saying, these patients should not be getting cisplatin. But here you have creatinine clearance of greater than 40 and you can get cisplatin and they're doing well. So I think that's one of the pearls of this study, right? So you can, it gives you some comfort saying that you can push the boundaries in terms of what your creatinine clearance can actually be and still get a benefit of the drug. The other thing is, clearly, you're seeing a benefit in those patients that do not have a path CR. We know that Nivo is already approved in that setting, but you're probably overtreating some patients, but you're clearly seeing that immunotherapy in this perioperative setting is driving a response.
Yeah, I think ctDNA is going to be the future here. It's not quite ready for prime time. There's a couple of studies out there. Deval mentioned one of them. So dostarlimab to Nivo is interesting. Gemcitabine is interesting. I think those are probably the two best regimens out there. We can debate which is right for which patient. We actually had a whole podcast on this. If you want to go back into your phones and search it in the feed, it was one of the first podcasts released. And we had some great guests and discussion on that. So we won't go back into that today, but I think it is an interesting conversation piece. So, all right, let's drive forward and let's get to the last subject here.
So the last trial we are going to discuss is the update on the TALAPRO-2 trial, which was presented at GU/ASCO a couple months ago. Going back to the study design, the TALAPRO-2 study looked at adding talazoparib, I'll just call it tala for simplicity, and combining it with enzalutamide as first-line treatment for metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer patients. Importantly, there were stratification factors built into the trial to look at prior use of abiraterone or docetaxel in the castrate-sensitive state, and also looking at HRR gene alterations. If you look here, that the trial had actually two cohorts. One was a cohort which included all comers, whether patients had HRR deficient status or non-HRR deficient status, and then cohort two had patients only with HRR mutated status. You can see here the trial design was straightforward, as I mentioned, randomizing patients to tala plus enza versus placebo plus enza. And the primary endpoint was radiation progression-free survival or radiological progression-free survival, with a key secondary endpoint of overall survival. If you look here, this is the original publication or original presentation from 2023. When it was presented originally, there was benefit of rPFS in all comers, in all patients, and also in the HRR deficient patients. Updated analysis that was presented at GU/ASCO continues to show overall survival benefit when you take the entire patient population together. Same thing that we see here in the HRR gene altered patients, the overall survival benefit continues to be statistically significant. Now, in this current day and age, we cannot ignore genomics. So even though all comers, there was an overall survival benefit, when you look at subgroup analysis, the benefit seems to be being driven by the HRR status. If you look at the patients who had HRR deficient status, they had significantly better outcomes or overall survival, but in patients who had non-HRR deficient status, the confidence interval does cross one. So it kind of puts you question whether this is benefiting every patient or not. In terms of toxicity, this combination is toxic. talazoparib is associated with significant myelosuppression, which is a class effect of the PARP inhibitors. Significant myelosuppression, primarily anemia, that can often lead to need for transfusions or dose reduction that can have, quite significant quality of life impact on our patients. Although looking at quality of life data, at least for the trial report, there was not much difference in the quality of life between the two arms. In terms of informative censoring, I'll go back to John.
This one's tricky because there's the two drugs. So when you're so I think point one is whether was there a big drop-off in the patients randomized to placebo versus the investigational arm? Of course, the answer is no because they got placebo. They didn't know what they were getting, and that's confirmed here. It was only two patients in placebo did not receive the intervention. It's a little trickier than when you go on to like which drug did they discontinue because you got this four group thing. So I don't have too much to add here. I would say not an obvious problem, but more challenging to interpret.
So in terms of like the clinical trial evaluation that we look at as pathways, kind of the trial met all the criteria that we would look as a pathways committee. It was a randomized large phase three trial. The control arm received the standard of care, which is Enza, and there was benefit of overall survival as well as quality of life data was reported. And at least from what we can say, there was no informative censoring. So then the question is, how do we translate this into clinical practice? I guess I can start, Manoj. From what we looked at is that, I think the benefit is really being driven in the HRR deficient patients. And I think those are the patients who may benefit the most from this combination. The other big thing that gives me a pause to use this regimen in all patients is that only about 5% or 6% of patients in this trial received ARSI drug like abiraterone in the castrate-sensitive state. Right now, the current standard of care is for every patient to receive, ADT plus ARSI in the castrate-sensitive phase. So we are really exposing patients to these drugs much earlier in their line of treatment. And then, if I have a patient in the clinic who has already progressed on abiraterone and they have one of these HRR mutations, I think we'll have to have a discussion whether I give them the combination drug or single agent PARP inhibitor. That's the discussion to have with the patient.
Yeah, it's interesting. So from a pathway standpoint, if you don't have much to go from an informative sensitive censoring standpoint, then you're looking at toxicity, the phase three randomized study and everything else, right? And from being like a specialist, academician, whatever you want to call it, you're looking primarily at that situation. Here, you're kind of seeing both merge, saying that this was an oral session at ASCO GU, one of the big topics that came up for using this combination in all-comer castration-resistant prostate cancer for first-line therapy. And I think the consensus really is probably not ready for prime time, but
the big question being all comers versus the HRR deficient.
Yeah.
And the design here was a little weird, right? Because you got these two cohorts. The first cohort was kind of like the all comers design, and then the second cohort was the HRR deficient design. And then they conducted those sequentially and then merged all the data for this analysis. Is that how it went? So that's a little bit of a challenge, right? And so you showed that as designed, there was an overall survival benefit for the whole population. So one argument would be if you go according to the trial design, this should be available for all patients.
Yes.
And the subset analysis is hypothesis generating.
Sure.
And you have a subset analysis that shows a trend towards that's an overall survival forethought, overall survival benefit in the non-HRR deficient patients. So this is where things get subjective in our value pathways discussions.
So I guess we'll stay tuned and see how what the approvals end up being and what you guys end up deciding. I think it's interesting because it's this debate of is there synergy where it's one plus one is three when you add in an AR targeting drug and a PARP inhibitor and maybe resensitizing some of those cells that don't have those biomarker HRR mutations to the actual PARP inhibition. But we have to remember a lot of patients on this study required transfusions. There's a lot of toxicity associated in a pre-chemo population, right? Almost a third of patients requiring transfusions. Manoj will maybe dig up that data and quote me on it. But I think that this is something that needs to be discussed. I kind of am agreeing a little bit with Deval, but I want to see more data is coming in June. And it's interesting to see those thoughts that are already starting to formulate in the pathway committee's mind as to what might happen in the future and what might not. But of course, more data is coming. So we'll see where that goes. Are we out of slides? Manoj, move us forward. Let's see where we're at.
Hey, Ben, I just want to add one more thing too. You hit on a lot of points I think our pathways committee would be hitting on. You know, okay, you know, let's talk a little bit more about these toxicities. You know, what was the quality of life? What were the transfusion requirements? Because all that stuff really comes up. And if we're, and it becomes a sort of weight where, or balance where you're saying like, look, you know, on the one hand, there's this trend towards an overall survival benefit in all comers, even the non-HR deficient patients. But on the other hand, you've got this weight of toxicity, you've got the added cost, you've got a limitation where only 5% of the patients had previous exposure to something like abiraterone. So these are all factors that really get weighed in. In a scenario where discussion is going to be challenging or maybe somewhat controversial, this is a scenario where we'll set up a debate. You know, we'll have Dhaval battle it out with someone else on the committee and see what people think, just to really make sure we consider these issues from all angles. So that's something we're trying to do.
Okay, great. And now summarize for us. We got a few minutes left. Summarize the pathway task force review process. We have two slides for you to kind of give us anything we haven't heard. Someone on stage, can you kind of summarize for us?
I mean, I can kind of hit this one if that's okay. I mean, some of this is just kind of review because I think we're just kind of reviewing for everybody what our pathways committee is trying to achieve and just going down the bullets. We are trying to provide critical reviews of clinical trial reports to determine whether these novel therapies are providing value. And you've heard about the challenges in defining value, but it incorporates considerations of clinical benefit, toxicities, costs, and a critical review of the limitations of the trials. We review these decisions over time. We made that point where we'll review it at first publication, we'll review critical articles that come out about it, and we'll review follow-up publications and presentations at national meetings. Our decisions do not always correlate with the FDA. FDA may approve something that we don't, and sometimes we'll approve things even before they have FDA approval, and they also do not correlate with whether they were published in the New England Journal. No, nothing to offend the reviewers of the New England Journal, but Ben, I maintain what I said, which is, you know, I think we could all stand to do a better job of critiquing some of these trials, including all of us who review papers. And then just finally, that our recommendations are always a subset of NCCN guidelines. So if something isn't deemed, you know, appropriate for NCCN guidelines, it will not be on the pathways. Now, we might anticipate something coming on the NCCN guideline soon, and we'll approve it pending an NCCN guideline update. So we'll sometimes do that, but it will not actually go on the pathways until it's on to NCCN.
Great. I think we had a great discussion. Thank you to Dr. Shaw and Dr. Burke for joining us on this episode, reviewing pathways and how we look at data for this. But we do have the privilege of being in a live audience here, Ben. So I'm going to open it up to ask any questions from anybody that's here. You have experts from GU, but you also have the pathway, Dr. Burke, who leads the pathways. So questions.
If you're in decision-making, how do you take the confounding factors of next line of therapy into play? Especially like in a prostate cancer patient where there's other novel antigen therapy that most likely those patients will go on after progression.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're getting to the point of that, you know, what we really want to know is, do these treatments impact overall survival? But it's so challenging to measure that in these diseases with long lifespans, and people may get, you know, seven different therapies after this initial therapy, and so of course we need these surrogate endpoints like PFS and DFS and all the others that we use. You know, in terms of, do we consider next line of therapy? I mean, I wouldn't say it's a big focus other than in our critique of like an adjuvant trial. We talked about the scenario where, you know, when the KEYNOTE-564 was initially reported, only about a third of the patients have been offered, you know, immunotherapy as when they develop metastatic disease. And so that was something we looked at and considered. And then, you know, with longer follow-up, it turns out it's actually about 70% of the patients on the placebo arm who had progressed then were offered what we'd consider a standard therapy with immunotherapy for metastatic disease. So we do look at that at next line of therapy in that sense too, to just understand the adequacy of whether patients were offered the correct treatment when they had progression of disease.
John, I was wondering if you can comment. You know, a lot of these new drugs are approved on the accelerated approval pathway through FDA, and how PTF is handling that aspect of.
Yeah. So PTF will still, consider drugs that have accelerated approval. As you point out, it's a very common thing these days. So actually, a lot of our approvals are for that. They're typically based on, you know, endpoints of, response rate or things like that that sort of have less of a clear link to clinical benefit. And so if we feel, so we'll consider it, we'll review it, and then we come back to it. So we have a process by which every 6 to 12 months, we will look at all of our accelerated approvals and say, okay, you know, this one got approved a year ago, and we're going to regularly reassess whether this still belongs on pathway. And the things we consider at that point are whether sort of a confirmatory study is ongoing, as is always required for these accelerated approvals, whether we know anything about those confirmatory studies, and whether we feel that sort of a good faith effort is being made to conduct those confirmatory studies, whether there's been any change in a toxicity profile that we've learned about. So those are kind of the considerations that go into monitoring our accelerated approvals after we've approved them, to make sure we're keeping close tabs on them. Thanks for the question, Les. Yeah.
Hey, so I appreciate the communication on this, and this is pretty important up front, but the question that I have for you is, when you're reviewing longer follow-up reported studies, I would assume that what you've looked at before is going to continue to show up with the sensory stuff that you guys are looking at. Is there a way that you guys actually include some sort of quality in here? If you remove something from pathway and you make a decision not to go with it, how do you look over time and actually look at what's going on in the real world? I mean, we see these retrospective studies that come out demonstrating patients that got medicines or didn't get medicines that are easy to follow in publications and stuff like that. I would think this would be real easy with the technology you guys have to not just analyze what the longer term follow-up is of the study, but actually look at what your study is of your patients versus ones that actually got the therapy.
Let me make sure I understand the question. So if I restate it.
So how did the pathway perform against the real world? So if you're saying that something's not going to go into pathway and you have enough patients that are out there and you're able to demonstrate, like, we made a decision from a value perspective that this patient's not going to be offered this medication. Do you ever do a cross comparison of patients that would have gone down that track, essentially creating a real world evidence track of pathway versus academics, so to speak?
Yeah, I would say no, we don't do that sort of thing. And just to be clear, we never make a decision about whether a patient would be offered a treatment. We just make a decision about whether a regimen or a drug would be on pathway. But it's up to the individual physician as to whether, you know, they want to offer that treatment to their patient. But no, we don't have kind of a scientific research where we sort of review path, you know, I think what you're asking about an individual patient or something like that. Now, we have done reviews of patients who get treated on pathway versus not on pathway. Les and I and others published, and Marcus, I think, published a paper on this in lung cancer a number of years ago, suggesting, you know, favorable outcomes for patients who were treated on pathway. And there's other publications in literature about that as well. But yeah.
So going back to the, you know, the renal cell carcinoma KEYNOTE trial, you know, as we get more data, we're learning that all T3s are not the same, right? I mean, it's just T3 with vascular involvement, T3 with, you know, it has been surgically resected, but it was, you know, piercing the fascia there. So does pathways go back and look at this and maybe annotate the data saying that, hey, there's higher risk within the subset and kind of guide, you know, physicians in the practice.
That hasn't really come up, but I don't know, what is that something you guys are talking about in the field as to, you know, the subsets of T3s, and should we bring that up on the pathway? I would say that's not something that we've done before, but that I can remember, but
yeah,
we certainly could, you know.
I don't think we have enough data to say that there's a differentiation between T3A, T3B. Like we don't have that, and I don't recall seeing any data that specifies or looks at, in the Keynote trial at least, how many patients were in that subset. Ben, do you remember specific subset?
It's the majority of patients were T3. I don't remember the T3A, T3B breakout, but the majority of patients that drove the analysis were not T4, they weren't M1 AMD, they were T3 node 0. We do know from our urology colleagues that patients with T3B or some of those other features just mentioned in the audience are more likely to have a recurrence. We can therefore hypothesize that they're more likely to get benefit. And if you look at the M1 patients in that study, they have the most significant benefit by giving pembrolizumab, obviously those patients with metastatic disease. So we can hypothesize that this is the spectrum, more benefit for patients at higher risk. However, we don't have definitive data to prove that we should be not giving this drug to T3As. And therefore, in my practice, I'm offering this to everyone because we get one chance at cure. And sure, there is harm potentially in the immunotherapy-related side effects. But for me, unless we see data to suggest that in patients with T3A that don't have those other risk features that are pure clear cell without sarcomatoid features are not getting benefit from the drug, my default would be that not to weigh into those weeds. But of course, if you have a patient with risk factors for immunotherapy toxicity, that's that shared decision-making between a patient and a provider that I completely agree with, bringing in the differences between some of those different T3 patients that are different.
Yeah, I completely agree with what you're saying, Ben. And I think from a pathway standpoint, I don't think we can differentiate at that granular level to say that these patients should and these patients should not. I think if they've hit the inclusion criteria, then the recommendation from the community, from the GU community, would be, yeah, we should offer this to the high-risk patients. So I really do want to thank our panelists. Dr. Burke, thank you so much. Dr. Shaw had to leave to catch a flight, but we'll thank him as well for joining us. Ben, always great to see you. Thank you all for joining us at Oncology Decoded. Please follow us on X at Oncology Decoded. Email us at podcast at Oncology Decoded as well. And that's all I have. Ben, anything else?
Well, follow us on Apple or Spotify. So search Oncology Decoded, subscribe. Please give us 5 stars. We love that attention. And thank you all for listening, and sorry I wasn't there in person.
Thank you.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Thanks.
Thank you all very much. And for our last, in case you missed it, segment, please help me welcome Allison Braden.